So thank you for being part of what we're doing here today. These are very unusual circumstances. I appreciate Hilton and Ray and the quality job that they've done in leading us this morning in unusual circumstances. And I got to thinking also that if I had a sermon designed exactly for Ray Coney's in Hilton Hill, this is exactly the moment to preach it. But I really don't. I have a sermon that I think is really needed by me and hopefully is needed by all of you, and all of us as we look into the Word of God together can benefit from it. We sometimes say that relationships are two-way streets, that it's like driving a car, that the cars pass each other and both sides have to, you know, obey the traffic laws and manage their cars, etc. But sometimes, like driving, we're more focused on what the other guy is doing than what we're doing. And I want you to consider some statements here. And do we have the PowerPoint up, Ray? There we go. Thank you very much. If you consider the statement made in Romans chapter 13, look how plain and simple the Apostle Paul is putting it to us here about our duty. He says, "Owe no one anything except to love each other. For the one who loves another has fulfilled the law. The commandments, you shall not commit adultery, you shall not murder, you shall not steal, you shall not covet, and any other commandment are summed up in this word, you shall love your neighbor as yourself. Love does no wrong to a neighbor, therefore love is the fulfilling of the law." It's pretty clear. We're commanded to love one another, which as I look in my relationships at the other person, that means God wants them to love me. And when they don't love me, they're wrong. But again, it's a two-way street. Consider the statement made by Jesus in Matthew chapter 18 in light of this command of the other person to love me. If you look at Matthew chapter 18, Jesus gives a warning in verse 5 to 7. He says, "Whoever receives one such child in my name receives me. But whoever causes one of these little ones who believe in me to sin, it would be better for him to have a great millstone fastened around his neck and to be drowned in the depth of the sea. Woe to the world for temptations to sin, for it is necessary that temptations come, but woe to the one by whom the temptation comes." Other translations say here, instead of temptation, offense. What it's saying here is that when you treat another person a certain way, or you live before them in a certain way that makes it hard for them to do the right thing, that you tempt them to do the wrong thing, that you provide an obstacle or an offense to them, we understand from other passages that that person who commits sin is wrong, but Jesus is warning the person who offends or puts a temptation in front of others that you're wrong too. So think about this. In any relationship, your mate, other family members, your co-workers, your neighbor, your brothers and sisters in Christ, they're supposed to love you. And others are responsible for that. But a good question is this: am I making it easier or harder for them to love me? Am I tempting them to have the wrong attitude toward me and putting an offense in front of them in doing the right thing regarding me? We understand that in any relationship, we can be a help in that relationship, or we can be a burden, an offense, and we can be trouble in that relationship. So, a good question here, in a lot of this warning not to be an offense or a temptation, is do I make it difficult for people to love me? Now, we all understand biblically, and certainly the Lord's Supper is a poignant reminder of this, that God loved us when we were unlovable. And it's the great heart of the gospel that God showed us love through Jesus when we didn't deserve it. But once we accept that love, we're to be transformed by that love. And we're called to love others, irregardless, even when they're not lovable. But as followers of Jesus Christ, We are also commanded to become the new person and put away certain things. And a lot of those things harm our relationships, anger and strife and jealousy and those kinds of things. As followers of Jesus, we're now called to be the kind of people that are now lovable. That we become the kind of people that are easier to love. For instance, the one who loved the unlovable Jesus, think about how lovable Jesus was. How people wanted to be near him and listen to him, and they just loved being in his presence if they had earnest hearts. So that's what I want to talk about this morning. I want to talk about being a lovable person, and I want to use a great biblical example of this, and that is the woman in the Old Testament, Ruth. And I want to talk about how that she was a person who was loved because she was lovable. So turn with me to the book of Ruth in the Old Testament. Ruth is there at the point in Israelite history where they've come into the land of Canaan. They're yet under the kings. It's in the Judges period. And as we start Ruth chapter 1 and we look at the beginning of this story that we're given, we see that the Israelites are in trouble. It's the period of the judges, which means this was a period when they had cycles of faithfulness and unfaithfulness, and when they were unfaithful, Israel had trouble. They had trouble with their enemies, and here we see they're having trouble even with providing enough food. Ruth chapter 1, 1 to 5. In the days when the judges ruled, there was a famine in the land, and a man of Bethlehem in Judah went to sojourn in the country of Moab, he and his wife and his two sons. The name of the man was Elimelech, and the name of his wife, Naomi. And the names of his two sons were Mahlon and Chilion. They were Ephrathites from Bethlehem in Judah. They went into the country of Moab and remained there. But Elimelech, the husband of Naomi, died, and she was left with her two sons. These took Moabite wives. The name of the one was Orpah, and the name of the other, Ruth. They lived there about 10 years, and both Mahlon and Chilion died, so that the woman was left without her two sons and her husband. So the book starts off on a tragic note. Famine in the land, they have to go to another place to get food, and then after getting there, the husband dies, and later on, the two sons die. So Naomi is in a very vulnerable position, especially in this time. In an ancient period, that a woman left without husbands and without sons was, this person was really vulnerable to mistreatment and hunger and things such as that. So she's in a really vulnerable situation. We read over the next several verses that Naomi decides to go back to Israel. Evidently, things are better. And so she's going to go back to Israel. And initially, the two daughters-in-law want to go back with her. But she encourages them to stay home in Moab, to go back to their own families, because she can't provide without a husband any more children, any more sons for them to marry. But Ruth makes a choice to stay with Naomi. And we read about this in Ruth chapter 1, verse 15 to 17. And she said, speaking of Naomi, "See, your sister-in-law has gone back to her people and to her gods. Return after your sister-in-law." But Ruth said, "Do not urge me to leave you or to return from following you. For where you go, I will go. And where you lodge, I will lodge. Your people shall be my people and your God, my God. Where you die, I will die, and there I'll be buried. May the Lord do so to me and more also if anything but death parts me from you." And when Naomi saw that she was determined to go with her, she said no more. What is behind Ruth's decision? We're not told completely. I think it's possible that she sees Naomi as a very troubled and vulnerable person in need of someone to take care of her. And a lot of Ruth's character, that certainly fits the situation. Maybe there is a faith dimension here. That Orpah and Ruth were told by Naomi to go back to their families and go back to their gods, but Ruth decides to come and make Naomi's God, singular, her God. And so it may very well be that Ruth has come around on this thing that there is only one true God. But nonetheless, Ruth decides to stay with Naomi. And it's a critical choice for Ruth. And it's an important development in the history of the Bible, even. Well, when they get back, it's not easy. Chapter 2, verses 1 to 3. Now, Naomi had a relative of her husband, a worthy man of the clan of Elimelech, whose name was Boaz. And Ruth the Moabite said to Naomi, "Let me go to the field and glean among the ears of grain after him, in whose sight I shall find favor." And she said to her, "Go, my daughter." So she went, so she set out and went and gleaned in the fields after the reapers. And she happened to come to the part of the field belonging to Boaz, who is of the clan of Elimelech. Well, this says a lot to us. Ruth and Naomi have no visible means of providing for themselves. They have to turn to an action called gleaning. This was not an uncommon practice in ancient times, and it was prescribed in the law of Moses, in the book of Leviticus, in a couple of places there. It's also found in Deuteronomy, that when someone owns a field and they planted grain, that as they're harvesting the grain, if some of the heads of grain fall to the ground, they're not to pick it up. And they were also, and this is in the law of Moses, they were not to harvest the grain stalks to the edge of the field. In other words, they were to leave along the edge of the fields and in the corners a little grain standing. And this was for the poor. The poor would follow the reapers, and they would pick up the extra heads of grain that fell to the earth, and they would go to the edge of the field, and they would cut the stalks, and they would take that grain and thresh it for themselves. It wouldn't be a lot, but it would be enough to keep them living. Well, that's the situation that Ruth and Naomi are in. And while there, she encounters Boaz. In chapter 2, verse 5, "Then Boaz said to his young man who was in charge of the reapers," whose young woman is this? There were a lot of reapers and a lot of gleaners. But somehow Ruth stood out because Boaz didn't know who she was, and there could be other reasons. And so he inquires of her. In chapter 2, verse 8, we see this interaction. "Then Boaz said to Ruth," after he learns who she is, by the way. She learns who he is from his workers. She's the one that's come back with Naomi. "Then Boaz said to Ruth," verse 8, "Now listen, my daughter, do not go to glean in another field or leave this one, but keep close to my young women. Let your eyes be on the field that they are reaping and go after them. Have I not charged the young men not to touch you? And when you're thirsty, go to the vessels and drink what the young men have drawn." Then she fell on her face, bowing to the ground, and said to him, "Why have I found favor in your eyes, that you should take notice of me, since I'm a foreigner?" But Boaz answered her, "All that you've done for your mother-in-law since the death of your husband has been fully told to me, and how you left your father and mother and your native land and came to a people that you did not know before. The Lord repay you for what you've done, and a full reward be given you by the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wings you've come to take refuge." Then she said, "I found favor in your eyes, my Lord, for you've comforted me and spoken kindly to your servant, though I'm not one of your servants." You see something present here between Ruth and Boaz. You see a mutual kindness shown one to the other. And you see a mutual respect shown one to the other. Ruth is respecting him as the lord of this field and this landowner and one who has an ability to help provide for her and Naomi, and he's doing that. And he shows her respect because he knows her reputation. Oh, she's the Moabitess that brought Naomi back and has been caring for her after Naomi's great loss. So he respects her for that and treats her kindly. And this has an incredible ending. And you probably know that. There was a tradition, probably in this part of the world at this time, and even, again, prescribed by the law of Moses, that if an Israelite died, then his brother or near kinsman would take his wife and bring up children in his name. So, because of Boaz's kindness, Naomi sees this as an opportunity for Ruth, and she encourages Ruth in chapter 3 to approach Boaz to do this responsibility. And Ruth does, and Boaz is touched, and he decides to do it. However, we find in chapter 4 that Boaz has to check with another kinsman who's closer kin to Ruth's husband to see if he would make that effort and take that responsibility, and he passes. And Boaz accepts the responsibility of taking Ruth as a wife and raising up children in the name of the family that has died. And here we see the outcome to this relationship, which connects it to the flow of biblical events. In chapter 4, verse 13, "So Boaz took Ruth, and she became his wife, and he went into her, and the Lord gave her conception, and she bore a son. Then the woman said to Naomi, 'Blessed be the Lord, who has not left you this day without a redeemer, and may his name be renowned in Israel. He shall be to you a restorer of life and a nourisher of your old age, for your daughter-in-law, who loves you, who is more to you than seven sons, has given birth to him.' Then Naomi took the child and laid him on her lap and became his nurse. And the women of the neighborhood gave him a name, saying, 'A son has been born to Naomi.' They named him Obed. He was the father of Jesse, the father of David." Well, we've not done this story justice. We've just quickly zipped through it. It is one of the great pieces of literature in the Bible. People who aren't believers in the scriptures who encounter Ruth as a piece of literature, they're just blown away by it. They just love the book of Ruth. And it is. It's just a marvelous story. Great writing. And here we see that this child that's born to Ruth and Boaz becomes this ancestor to David, which means he's in the lineage of the Christ. And that the Christ will come and be the son of David. And Ruth is part of all this. And Boaz is part of this. And in a way, Naomi is part of this, because from this comes Obed, who brings about Jesse, who brings about David. It's an incredible thing that happens. But it's not just that Ruth is a name in a lineage that makes her important. There are plenty of people who are in the lineage of Jesus. And you see their lists even in the New Testament, like Matthew chapter 1. But Ruth is expanded in the biblical text. We get a window into this woman, into her character. Some of the people in Jesus' lineage, we don't. There are a lot of men in Jesus' lineage we know nothing about except their name. But we know quite a bit about Ruth, and especially her character. And I want you to see this about Ruth. Ruth was a Moabitess. She came as a foreigner among these people. But these people grew to love Ruth. You see that here. And I want to propose to you this morning that it was easy to love Ruth, because Ruth was lovable. And shouldn't we be too? If we appreciate the unconditional love that God has given to us, and how that love has transformed us, and we understand what the New Testament teaches, and that is that love should transform who we are and our character, and we see that Ruth exemplifies many of those characteristics, and thus we should strive to love others regardless, but we should also strive to be as lovable as possible so we're not an offense to other people and provide a temptation to them not to have the right attitude or the right treatment toward us. So note these characteristics with me about Ruth. First of all, we see that she was lovable because she was kind to her family, her spouse, her mother-in-law, etc. Look what is said about Ruth in chapter 1, verse 8. When Naomi is discussing what she's going to do, she's going to go back to Israel and she wants the girls to go stay in Moab. She says in chapter 1, verse 8, "But Naomi said to her two daughters-in-law, 'Go return each of you to your mother's house. May the Lord deal kindly with you as you've dealt with the dead and with me.'" Now, this says that Orpah was a kind person. But of course, our text is mostly focused on Ruth. And here, Naomi testifies that Ruth had been kind to the family members who had died and been very kind to her. And we see this over and over played out. We just read chapter 4, verse 15. When the women gather around Naomi and they celebrate the birth of the grandchild of Naomi, then, in essence, it's a grandchild. Then remember what they said to Naomi about Ruth? "Your daughter-in-law who loves you is more to you than seven sons," or some translations say has been better to you than seven sons. One example. Ruth was a woman who loved her family, even her in-laws, faithfully. And that's, in a way, where it should start. Because sometimes family can be the hardest people to love, and the people who have the hardest time loving us. There are natural affections that exist in family members, which sometimes make the relationships complex. But sometimes the most strained relationships are with spouses or children or parents or cousins or aunts and uncles or whoever. Sometimes we're patient and we're kind and we're helpful to just about anybody but our family. We'll think to perform a good deed for a neighbor or a stranger, but not the people with whom we live in the same house or have the same blood. We're very long-suffering with someone we work with, but when our mate or our child makes a mistake, we can be very, very harsh and patient. And sometimes it's a matter of taking them for granted. The familiar becomes so familiar that you don't think about the importance of the relationship. But I think there's a lot of passages that bear this out, including what the New Testament teaches about qualifications for elders. How we treat our family is one of the great character tests that we face. What we're like on the street, in the public, can be easy. That's the easy part. It's how we behave behind closed doors, in the intimate relationships of family, that oftentimes will reveal who we really are. It's sometimes the true measure of our character regarding how those who know us best view us. Do you ever feel like certain members of your family, close family or extended family, don't treat you right? Well, they have an obligation to treat you right. But are you helping them in that obligation? Are you making it easier or harder? Maybe they're struggling with loving you because you've not been very lovable. And it may be that some kindness on your part, like Ruth demonstrates, that some kindness on your part is what's needed to improve the relationship. A comfort when they're in need of comfort, support when they need it, forgiveness when they fail, and help when they're struggling with something. And regardless of how they treat you or how they've treated you in the past, kindness to them can be transformative. And consider the second point, which is in a way spinning off this first point, because Ruth demonstrates it so well. And that is, Ruth is a person who's thoughtful of others. In chapter 2, we read about her going to Boaz's field for the first time to glean. And we read this, chapter 2, verse 14. "And at mealtime, Boaz said to her, 'Come here and eat some bread and dip your morsel in the wine.' So she sat beside the reapers, and he passed to her roasted grain, and she ate until she was satisfied, and she had some left over." She is given a place at Boaz's table of all his workers. And she has all that she needed to eat. She was satisfied. Where it sounds like earlier in this chapter, that's been a rare occasion for Ruth. But here she is given abundance. And it says at the end of verse 13, she had some left over. Well, what happened to that leftover? Verse 18. She went home to Naomi that night with the grain that she had gleaned. And also this, verse 18. And she took it up and went into the city. Her mother-in-law saw what she had gleaned. She also brought out and gave her what food she had left over after being satisfied. She brought in the raw grain for them to thresh and to work and to bake. But she already had some cooked food, and she somehow put it aside and held on to it and got it to Naomi that evening. Even when she was away out of Naomi's sight and she was caught up in a situation, a heady situation, wow, I'm sitting here at Boaz's table and I've got all this food to eat, she thought of Naomi. It's a very subtle thing, but it means a lot. Food was scarce, and Ruth didn't just think of herself. She thought of Naomi. And that's a real step of maturity, to think beyond yourself and think of other people. And it's a real crucial step in being a Christian and maturing into Christ. Philippians chapter 2 tells us, let each of you look out not only for his own interests, but also for the interests of others. See, we're called to be thoughtful people of other people. That's what we're called to be as Christians. And that makes us very lovable. If all you do is think of yourself, you're not very lovable. If you only think about what you need and what you want and what you like and what problems you have and what bothers you and what... That is a very difficult thing for other people. If first and mostly you think about yourself, you're straining your relationships. And here's a good test on that. Whenever you have conversations with people, think back on those conversations. And maybe you're not being objective. Maybe you have to really just watch yourself when you have conversations. What's the subject of conversation? Do you exclusively or mostly just talk about your feelings, your thoughts, your problems, your needs, your opinions? Well, your experiences. I did this the other day and this happened to me. And the conversation with other people is just rarely, if ever, about them. That's certainly reflective on the fact that you're not being thoughtful of other people. And thoughtfulness can be a very simple thing. Jesus puts it like this in Matthew chapter 10 and verse 42, a cup of cold water in the name of a disciple. Just a cup of cold water, that's a very simple thing, can mean a lot. Doing small things, giving small things, showing just small attention. I'm reminded of a story I ran into, an actual story, like the book of Ruth, it's shortly after COVID started. And let me tell you about this story. It's come from the McDaniel family. So I know some of you know Terry McDaniel, who was a member of the congregation here back in the 90s. Most of you don't, but some of you do. I know the Metcalfs and the Coneys know who she is. The Hills know who she is. And Terry is an old friend of me and Lori, and we've been friends with her since the late 80s. And she lives up in Maryland, and her and her family are Christians, and they were in the church where I preached in Maryland years and years ago. And after COVID hit, she passed on a story that was written by one of the family members. And it really impressed me. And the story was about the 1918 flu. Because a lot of people in our culture, they were talking about the 1918-1919 influenza outbreak, because there were a lot of parallels between that and COVID. And Terry's family lived over in East Tennessee. And one family in particular of her ancestors, they were smitten with the flu. And the flu was deadly. I mean, it was like COVID, you know. Thousands and thousands of people died, and people got really, really sick. Well, the story was told that this one family, they were just wiped out with the flu. They were just, some of them were on their deathbeds and they were so sick because they lived on a farm. And they understood that you don't get near people, you could get the flu. So that was an understanding. But one of their neighbors came every morning. They were so sick, they couldn't work. They couldn't do anything. And every morning, one of their neighbors would come to their farm. And after a while, they would walk out to the front porch. And on the front porch would be a stack of firewood that he had cut up, a jug of milk where he'd milk their cow, and a basket of eggs where he'd gathered their eggs. They were so sick, they couldn't get out and cut wood and get milk from them, milk the cow and gather the eggs. They were just too sick. And he knew that. And he would just go every morning for days and days and days, cut the wood, milk the cow, gather the eggs, put them on the porch for them to come out and have warmth and have nourishment. That's thoughtfulness. And that's powerful. How do you think that family thought, what they thought about that neighbor? Well, all those folks are dead and gone. That was over 100 years ago. But all the way now in 2022, and I don't know the man's name. I guess I could go look at the email, look at the story and get the name. I don't remember the name. But what he did still lives on, and he's still admired for that. And I love him for it. That's a Ruth action, for sure. So whatever you can do to show interest in someone and that you understand them and that you care for them and do something for them, it endears you for them, to them. You don't do it to get them to love you. You do it because it's the right thing, because you love them. But you know what the outcome is? You become a lovable person. And it really affects relationships. Here's something else that Ruth demonstrates very plainly here. Very plainly. She's a hard worker. In chapter 2, verse 7, we read in verse 5 of chapter 2 that Boaz came up and said, "Who is this young woman?" You know. And the reapers tell him in verse 6, "She's the young Moabite woman who came back with Naomi from the country of Moab." And look at this, verse 7. She said, "Please let me glean and gather among the sheaves of the reapers." She's asking for work. And this is what they said. "So she came and she's continued from early morning until now, except for a short rest." And then we read in chapter 2, verse 11 and 12, that Boaz said, "All that you've done for your mother-in-law since the death of your husband has been fully told to me." Verse 12, "The Lord repay you for what you've done." Action. What you've done. We see that Ruth is someone who sees what needs to be done and does it. She's responsible. She's a worker. You know, we can assume, maybe, that Boaz was attracted to her. I don't know. We should read into that. Some people try to make this a romance story. I don't think we can go that far and say it's strictly a romance story. However, and we just studied Song of Solomon a few weeks ago, men and women are men and women. 2022 or back, you know, this is 1,000 years before Jesus. Okay, this is about 1,000 years before Jesus was born. So men have always been men and women have always been women, and it could have been that he was smitten with her beauty or charm, and she was smitten with his charm. I don't know. That could play here. I do know this. He says it. He is impressed with what she had done. You know, 1 Thessalonians 4, 11 and 12 teaches us to work with our own hands as Christians. And what that text is about is it's addressing Thessalonians who weren't working. They were not responsible in providing for themselves. The Bible teaches that a Christian works, provides for themselves, provides for others. You're an active, responsible person. One thing that will certainly create strain in any relationship, whether it's home or work, in the neighborhood or family, church, whatever, is when you don't carry your load. You expect other people to do everything. You don't do your share. You don't meet your responsibilities. You don't meet your obligations. You don't follow up on your commitments. You know, some people, maybe even in a congregation, They somehow sense they're not that loved. A good question is why? Well, they should be loved. But if you're not carrying your load in the congregation, if you're not working and trying and doing things and helping others, how do you expect to build bonds of love? It's not going to happen. There are people who are part of a church and they expect a certain group to do everything. And they just sort of watch. That doesn't make for good relationships. It doesn't make for loving relationships. Loving relationships are born out of people shoulder to shoulder, bearing down and working together and sweating together and struggling together. That builds bonds. And it's so in family or in the neighborhood or at the workplace. Because when you don't work, you tempt people to resent you. When you don't work, they have to pick up the slack. You're tempting them to have a bad attitude towards you, to be angry with you. And they're responsible for that. But why would you want to do that? Why would you want to put that on them? But if you're the kind of person who fulfills your responsibilities and you help other people and you're a worker, you're going to be appreciated and admired, and you're going to build bonds with people. People will want to pair with you at work. Oh, I want to work with him on that project. I want to do that with her because she'll really be a good worker. People want to be around you. They want to be your neighbor. And Boaz here, he shows great wisdom. Boaz is approached about taking Ruth as a wife, and Boaz takes her as a wife. And Boaz shows great wisdom in this. And he's older than her by some years, evidently, according to chapter 3. And maybe it's not the most romantic notion. I'm not saying that Boaz sent her a card, a love note, and said, "Ruth, oh my dear one, baby, I love the way you glean." He probably didn't do that, okay? But if he did write down what impressed him about Ruth, it was that she was a gleaner. She was a worker. She was a servant. And some of you aren't married who's listening to this. And this is a real important lesson for you. Romance is a real thing. We've talked about that recently. But it's not the only thing. And some of you need this lesson. Now, the guy sitting here with me, you guys, these guys are taken, by the way, Hilton and Ray, they're taken. So don't know why they're taken, but they're taken. But some of you have that decision on who you're going to marry one day. And it's more important to look for a mate that's responsible and a good worker and reliable than a good-looking mate. Because after a period of time of them not being responsible and not working hard and not being reliable, that beauty and that handsomeness in your eyes, it's going to fade. They're not going to look so good. But Ruth is showing the qualities of the virtuous woman in Proverbs 31. She's showing this character that makes her, well, I don't know what Ruth looked like, but Ruth was a beautiful person. She was a beautiful person. And Boaz sees that beauty of her character. Two more things. If you look in chapter 2 here, you see there are two characteristics that emerge as Ruth talks with Boaz. In chapter 2, verse 10, remember what he says, what happens here when he says, "I want you to glean in my field. I want to make sure the workers don't harass you, the men don't harass you. I want to make sure you've got what you need here." In verse 10, she fell on her face, bowing to the ground, and said to him, "Why have I found favor in your eyes, that you should take notice of me since I'm a foreigner?" There's none of this, "Hey, you're related to my husband who died and left me. You should be helping me out." There's none of that. She's humbled before him. And in verse 13, she said, "I found favor in your eyes, my Lord, for you have comforted me and spoken kindly to your servant, though I'm not even one of your servants." Well, that sounds like the prodigal son, right? Go back and beg to just you know, my father's house, the servants have more food than I'm just going to go back and just beg just to be a servant, not even a son. And here she says, I'm not even one of your servants and you're treating me kindly. I'm not one of your workers. What humility she shows. There's an old saying that says, pride is the only disease known to man that makes everyone sick except the one who has it. I don't know who said that, ran into it years ago. But in this age of this day of sickness, that's an interesting concept that pride makes everybody sick around you. It's a repulsive thing. It's an ugly thing. Humility, on the other hand, is a beautiful quality to behold. And one reason why people may not be very loving towards you is because you turn their stomach. You brag. You have to be the center of attention. You steal the center of attention. You trample on other people's opinion. You carry an air of superiority. And there are certain circles in our world where asserting yourself and bragging on yourself and talking about how great you are and all this kind of stuff is like elevated as a virtue. It's not a virtue. It's ugly. When you thump your chest and crow about yourself, it's ugly. Ruth's not like that. And that's why a prideful person is a hard person to express gratitude toward. It's hard to encourage and praise a prideful person because you feel like you're throwing gasoline on a fire. However, humility is not offensive. People are more at ease around you, and they're motivated to give you encouragement and support and respect and even praise. You know, I can have to say the people in the kingdom of Christ that I've encountered over the years who have made the biggest impressions on me and who have been the greatest inspirations to me have been the humblest people. The humbler we are, the easier it is for people to love us. That's why Christ wants us to be humble. He wants us to be loved. And in those same verses, there's something else that you see. Ruth is humble in her disposition, but then she's grateful in her expression. She recognizes to Boaz, you have been kind to me. She's expressing gratitude. And it's a twin to humility. Humility and thankfulness go hand in hand. If you're arrogant, you're probably not thankful. And if you're thankful, you know, you probably have a degree of humility about you. They do go hand in hand. Do you enjoy doing something for someone who's not grateful? That you really make an effort, and it's not that you do it just to say, get them to say thank you, but you really make an effort. And you notice, like, days later, like, well, wow, they didn't say thank you. Now, that should never stop us from doing what we ought to do. But it is a barrier in their relationship. It may be the people around you don't show love like you would like for them to because you rarely acknowledge the good things they do for you. It's as if you expect them to do this and expect them to do that, and they feel manipulated, used, unappreciated. Do you expect people to do a lot for you? And this could be your neighbor, your coworker, a friend, your parents, your children, your brothers and sisters in Christ. You expect them to do this and expect them to do that. Do you think it's their duty and you think it's your right to receive this? That's the wrong way to look at it. Thankfulness begins with humility that's bred out of an attitude that people don't owe you things. You don't expect them to do this for you and that for you. So that when they do things for you, you really appreciate it, little or much. You're grateful for what they do. And it encourages you. And so you encourage them and you express love back to them. If we would be more thankful, it would transform relationships. And I think sometimes this is at the root of what's going on, even psychologically. That a person, and this builds on itself, a person doesn't feel loved in their relationships. And so they do two things. They don't feel loved, and so they withhold gratitude. Because they don't think people are treating them the way they ought to treat them. And the other thing they do, they don't feel loved, and so they want to heap themselves on other people. They want to talk about themselves and talk about their problems and talk about their needs because they're somehow shoving themselves on others to try to get them to give them attention and love them. When the reverse is true, a lack of gratitude and a lack of humility strains and drains a relationship. Humility and thankfulness sustains and fuels relationships. And it creates love that goes back and forth in a two-way street. If somebody treats me the wrong way, they're wrong. If somebody treats you the wrong way, they're wrong in that. But if we make it hard for them to do right by us, we're guilty too. So a very hard question is, you know, and it's a difficult one because you have to really look in the mirror, and that is, how lovable am I? Do you mostly think about how much others are loving you? Or do you focus also on your love toward others? And could it be that one of the keys to the problems that you're in relationships is that you're making it harder for people to treat you the right way and love you? And what the unconditional love of God through Christ is to do for us is to transform us into lovable people. Yes, the Gospels and the book of Acts is the great message about how Christ loved us and died for us even though we were guilty. And then the rest of the New Testament, those letters, are about putting off the old, ugly, wicked person and becoming this new, kind, loving, humble person. That is the transformation into a lovable person by the love of God. You know, and the issue really in our relationships is not how fair I'm being treated and how I'm being treated, but really the issue in my relationships is how I'm treating other people. That's really the key, transformation. Well, thank you for studying Ruth with me. It's just such a wonderful book.